everybody. Can you hear me? I think you can hear me. My name is Betty Sargent. I have the great privilege of being a member of the board of this wonderful library. For those of you who don't know, this is the oldest library in the city and one of the oldest in the country. In fact, one of our very first members was George Washington, and what he did was he borrowed two books and never returned them. So we're still kind of looking around for those books, and if anybody notices an old book somewhere, you just let us know. I'm really thrilled to be introducing Andrea this evening. She and I met when I was asked to be a fellow at the Library of America. And here at the Library of America, they have this wonderful woman, Andrea, who's kind of managing things. And one day she's mentioned to me, "Oh, I've written a book," she said. And I am an editor by trade, and I was very interested in that. And it turns out that this is the book that she had written, and I just couldn't believe it. I mean, this whole part of her life, her whole background with Ansel Adams, came as a complete surprise to me, and it's really a glorious thing. I just want to read a very short little thing that she wrote herself about her career. I'm going to try it without my glasses. "I first met Ansel Adams in 1972 when he came to New York to discuss an exhibition of his photographs at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where I worked. I was immediately impressed by his open, friendly demeanor, his sense of humor, and his modesty. We worked together for 2 years on the retrospective, and after it opened in the spring of 1974, he asked me to come to Carmel and become his assistant. I leapt at the chance, and off she went." I mean, how cool is that? You know, this young woman, and then she just uproots her life and goes off to California to work for Ansel Adams. And I think it was a life-changing event for Andrea, as you will soon see. This is an amazing book. It's gotten 5 stars at Amazon. And one of the quotes on their website is, "This is an essential and deeply satisfying book." She has also edited other books about Ansel and his works, including Letters and Images, Our National Parks, Ansel Adams in Color, and Ansel Adams 400 Photographs. One of the reviews that I was particularly struck with on Amazon, my primary resource these days, I'm a little embarrassed to say, goes as follows. This is the short review on Amazon. "I only wish I'd been able to meet the man in person, but this book got me as close as I possibly could be. And now, to get even closer, it is my pleasure to introduce Andrea Stillman."
Started yet? Thank you, Betty. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you for the New York Society Library, and thank you, Perry, for helping me set up this thing because don't know much about technical things, and she was very, very helpful. Now we'll see if we can just make this work. Usually when I lecture about Ansel, I kind of give a chronological overview of his work and show you early and late material and lots and lots and lots of pictures. But I decided since I'd give you a taste of what the book is, and this is not a plug for selling the book, let me tell you, because it's just that I love this stuff. So I thought I'd do something different. We delve more deeply into a few of his most important photographs. Maybe you'll remember some. Maybe you'll recognize some. So you have to start with Ansel on his first trip to Yosemite with his first camera because where else would you start? He's 14 years old. It's 1916, and he convinced his parents to go to Yosemite for a vacation. He was an only child of very elderly parents. His mother was over 40 when she had him, and if you think that he was born in 1902, wow, that always amazes me. So he was kind of a hothouse flower. He was often confined to his room because he was sick or ill. I don't know. He was even a hypochondriac when I knew him, and I think it started very early, courtesy of his mother. But when they arrived there in 1916 in June, they stayed in a tent cabin, and his parents presented him with this Kodak Box Brownie camera. This is the kind of camera that's so primitive that you don't develop the film. You take the camera to the photo finisher, and he removes the roll and develops it for you. So we're in the really early days of photography. And Ansel had taken a few pictures before with the family camera around San Francisco, and they weren't particularly memorable. This is his favorite photograph from that first visit in 1916. This is Half Dome, and unfortunately Half Dome is obscured by some trees. You can see that it's been mounted in an album. When he got home from the trip, his father helped him assemble this album, and it's a conservationist nightmare because it's on that acid black paper that they had at the time. So, you know, do you take it apart to preserve the rare vintage photographs, which are not printed by Ansel? It's his negatives, but it's printed by the photo finisher. And they're a little little dull, and they're really tiny, like this. And this is his father's handwriting underneath Half Dome. Ansel's handwriting was like hieroglyphics. He was obviously learning disabled, although they didn't diagnose those things at the time. And one of the hallmarks is really, really dreadful handwriting. And I became a past master at being able to read it. It's kind of like a foreign language. And he used to tell the story, and it doesn't really sound real, but he told it so many times that I asked his son, I said, do you think this is a true story? He said, I don't know, Pop told it so much. He said he went up, stood up on a stump to take this picture. He wanted a little more elevation. Later in life, he'd get up on top of his car, but at this point, he's standing on a stump. And as he clicked the shutter, the stump crumbled, and he catapulted to the ground, but he clicked the shutter. And so the photo finisher, when he went to pick up his prints, said, well, tell me, Ansel, how is it that this one photograph is upside down on the... However, this was his favorite picture from the trip. And this is a typical page, but that was the opening page with Half Dome, so, you know, pride of place. But this is a more typical page with, you know, there were five or seven pictures. And I want you to look at this photograph. That's the view from Inspiration Point that almost everybody photographs, and Ansel photographs it better than a lot of other people. And you'll see a photograph taken from the same spot later on, and you'll see how much he improves. You'll also see another photograph of El Capitan, and Big Oak Flax, no. So he has a ways to go here. And he always used to say, at this point, and he was making what he called a visual diary. He wanted to show you what he saw when he was on his vacation. And there, in the scrapbook, there are also pictures of the family. He took pictures of the family. So it was just like any of us when we take a trip. We come home and we paste our pictures in a... No, we don't do that anymore. We look at them online. But we used to paste them in a scrapbook with little labels. Shortly thereafter, this is 1927, so 1916. So 11 years later, he's 25 years old. And he makes this photograph of... Milestone Mountain in Sequoia, and he just adored this photograph. I think this photograph is just horrible. Everything about it, including the presentation, he would print it on this paper that was like watercolor paper, so it had this heavy textured, and his friend Edward Weston had this famous quote. He said, I don't care what you print it on, even a bath mat, as long as it's a good print. This is not a good print, but... At this period, you're trying to make your photographs look like anything except a photograph. You want it to look like an etching, a charcoal drawing, a lithograph, because no one will buy a photograph. In fact, the first photographs Ansel sold, he called them Parmelian prints. Parmelian's a made-up word. It maybe means para from the Greek. It maybe means, maybe. Ansel's not even sure who made it up. But no one would buy a photograph, and these were photographs were only $3.50. But even so, no one would buy something called a photograph. So at this point, you're trying to make your photographs not look like photographs. However, at the same time he's doing this, he also 2 years earlier made this photograph, which is just like his mature style: crisp, sharp, wonderful blacks, wonderful whites, marvelous clouds. Beautiful composition. I mean, look at the reflections in the lake, and you just feel that you're standing there at the same moment with Ansel next to his camera. And indeed, he said when he looked at his pictures, he was transported back in time and was standing there beside the camera as he clicked the shutter. That quote came about because I said, Ansel, we were always working with all these beautiful photographs, but at this point he had arthritis and he certainly wasn't trekking around the High Sierra. I mean, we would barely let him drive the car. And I said, don't you miss it? He said, well, dear, you know, I've been there and done, I've done that before, and besides, I can transport myself back to the moment in time, and so in fact, I don't miss it, which gave me a new thought. But anyway, I think this photograph's wonderful. This is Mount Clarence King from 1925, and it's as beautiful, the prints are as beautiful today, and he made some beautiful early prints then. He never printed this on the wavy paper, the watercolor type paper. He did print this just on glossy paper. This is what he looked like at the time. This is by his friend Francis Farquhar on a Sierra Club high trip. They're up in Tuolumne Meadows, and they go out for 6-week trips, and he's wearing, oh, look at that outfit, hasn't been washed, and those are his kids' basketball shoes that he says were the very best things to wear for hiking. Forget real boots. This was it. He wore these in snow no matter where he was. And that's his Sierra Club cup. Do anybody here know about the Sierra Club cup? The little, it's on his waist, yeah? And that you'd use that to drink from strings, which were not polluted, so you didn't get Giardia at that point. And he hated this picture. We call it the Basque sheep herder. And now I want to tell you about his first important photograph, what he called his first visualization. He set out on April 10th, 1927, with his future wife, Virginia Best, and three friends, Cedric Wright and Charlie. Anyway, you don't need to know their names. They're not famous. And they set out to go up to something called the Diving Board, which is a little tiny granite spur underneath Half Dome. You saw Half Dome. So if you're looking at Half Dome here, there's a little tiny granite spur that sticks out over here, and he wanted to hike up there. Even at age 30, I'm not sure I could have done this, and they did it in heavy snow, carrying heavy equipment. And so they're on their way up. So he's using, at this point, glass plates, because that's what you had, glass plates. They're heavy. Now, they are panchromatic, so that you can capture clouds, as opposed to orthochromatic, which just would be white sky. So they've made a little bit of progress, but still it's glass plates. And he has a really heavy tripod. It was still at his house when I was there, wood with metal. And then a 6.5, 8.5 view camera, which is heavy and bulky too. And then you've got his wife is carrying her movie camera, and the other friends along have their cameras, and they're struggling through this deep snow. So on the way up, so he's got 12 glass plates. On the way up, he makes some pictures. He stops. He just can't help it. This is his favorite peak. When we would fly over the Sierra, he would be able to point out every single peak, and he had climbed them many, many times. This was his favorite peak. And his quote to me was, "I know the Sierra like the back of my hand." And he really did. I mean, he just knew every peak. So this is one of his favorites. So he took this. Okay, so that's one plate down. Then he, when they get up to the, on the way up, he takes a few more. They get up there, and before he sets up his camera and starts photographing Half Dome, he gets Virginia, who's only his fiance, to climb out to the end. That's Virginia. None of the guys on the trip are out there, right? She's out there. So this is a kind of a typical photograph for the period. You get the near far with the tree in the foreground and everything. It's a little confused. He wasn't that fond of it later on in life, but I love it just because Virginia's there and because it shows how impossibly difficult this terrain was. So by the time he gets up to the granite spur, he's only got two glass plates left. The other 10, some were memorable photographs, most weren't. So he gets up there and he takes this photograph. Now, you can see we're looking at Half Dome obliquely here. And he sets up his 6.5, 8.5 camera and clicks the shutter, and then he's put on something called a K2 filter, which is a yellow filter. And that's to help with the separation of the sky and the snow. And I mean, filters are a whole science unto themselves. And then he stands there, and this is what he felt was revolutionary for him. He thought, oh, wait a second. When I print this negative in the darkroom and hand you a photograph, will you get the same feeling that I felt standing there? Will you feel the drama, power, and mystery of love of nature, overwhelming environmentalism, you know, every cliche you can think of? And he thought, no. And so he put on a deep red filter, which is number 29. And so here it is first. Look at the difference in the rock face, rock cliff, and the difference in the sky. And this is what he called his first visualization. So he had written to Virginia about 2 years before, "I have purchased a red filter. It will give a black sky, and the snow peaks set against such a sky will produce a startling effect." And here he was, you know, putting it into practice. Now, at the same time they were taking this hike, Virginia was carrying her movie camera, and she made a movie of part of the trip. And one day I was working at Ansel's house. He had died, and Virginia came up, his widow, she came up to the workroom where I had a lot of photographs laid out, and I was working on a book, and she said, "I just found all these movies, and I think that you might be interested in these, dear." So we rented a movie. They were really old movies, right? And we rented a projector and showed them, and some of them were, very few were Ansel interacting with his children. Mostly the children were just playing by themselves. And some family outings, but it included a film that Virginia had made that day on April 10th, 1927, of this hike to the diving board. And at some point, some piano music that Ansel recorded in 1947. He had originally started out to be a pianist. He kind of sat down at the age of 12 and could play. He was very much a genius, and he developed a beautiful, beautiful tone. But it was clear that either he was going to be a second-rate pianist, i.e., an accompanist, or a first-rate photographer, so piano just became fun. But at one point, some friends convinced him when he was in New York to go to a recording studio and record, even though he already had arthritis and was very out of practice. So you're going to hear him playing the Prelude in C from Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier. So now this is supposed to work. Ah, there we go. That's Ansel. They look down on the principal waterfalls as you go up towards Glacier Point, Nevada Fall and Vernal Fall. And that's Yosemite Falls across the valley. Guess who? Virginia. That's not Ansel's camera. That's another friend who was along. One slip in your toast. It was really fun to find that movie, let me tell you. It was really fun. And Ansel, he would only play it, by the time I knew him, he was 70, starting when he was 72 years old, he would only play if he was very drunk. And you had to kind of fool him into playing it. He still had his piano. He'd bought a Mason and Hamlin. He told Virginia he couldn't marry her because he'd bought a Mason and Hamlin piano, and he was going to have to pay $100 a month for the rest of his life and devote himself to music. So he broke their engagement to her. horror. I think he also had a lot of other girlfriends. There was a very there was a musical community in San Francisco that there was a lot of violin players and a lot of different things going on, and Virginia was rather plain and quiet, but she did have a beautiful voice. But anyway, Ansel wouldn't sit down at the piano very often, but when he did, you could still hear his wonderful, wonderful tone. And he talked to me about that prelude and see that you had to be so even, the whole thing has to be so even that it just kind of never stops. And I've tried, it's harder than it thinks. It's a very simple piece, but it's a very difficult piece to play. So here's Virginia with her movie camera. Now, this is on a different peak, a different trip, but I wanted you to see. So look at that big tripod. She was a real mountaineer. And even though this happened in 1927 when Ansel was only 25, he was already very well known in San Francisco. This is the top half of the Stockton Chronicle that has a story about the trip. And so here's Virginia sitting next to the tree that maybe you saw in the foreground. And here's Cedric Wright and... Now, this isn't Ansel's photograph because somebody else, no one's ever been able to tell me exactly who the person is, the camera that was set up there. I don't think that's Ansel's. I think that was somebody else taking a picture, and I think that's their picture here. So I don't think this is the first time this picture was in print. But I just wanted to show you that even at 25, he already had a big reputation in San Francisco. And I thought I'd throw in here a something that came up a few years ago. Remember when there was this brouhaha over a man had found these glass plate negatives by Ansel Adams and he bought them in a yard sale and he was going to make a fortune. He was going to print them and you could buy them for $10,000 each. And here I wanted to show you why they were patently, clearly not by Ansel. Anybody could have told this, and in fact, his two of his darkroom assistants said these are not by Ansel Adams, but they didn't want to hear that information. They listened to somebody else. So this is Ansel's picture of this tree on Sentinel Dome, which is now not even a stump. It's just gone. This is the Norsegan. This is the glass plate that they had. Well, look at the difference. Look at the Ansel. This is not a very interesting picture, but he's got some information in the tree here. Look at these beautiful clouds in this nice sky, and this the foreground composition. This is just a disaster. This is all blocked up, and this background is just terrible. And I mean, there's no way you could even in I don't even know in Photoshop. And Ansel's is from a better angle. This isn't such a good angle because I was just when they came out with this, I thought this is ridiculous. Whoever could have possibly thought these were Ansel Adams glass plates. Besides that, he never let anything go. So you would never find a glass plate. Now, we've been talking about photographs with large format, which was 6.5, 8.5. So it's not as big as 8x10, but it's still pretty big. He in 1936, he was given by Zeiss, Zeiss contacts. And he had always poo-pooed 35mm photography because... Well, he said it was for people in life, and he wasn't photographing people or life. He was photographing rocks. They don't move, so why would you need them? This was by his friend Edward Weston, and it's one of my favorite photographs. You can see how much his ears stuck out. And his fingers are already... He always said the other reason he couldn't be a concert pianist is he had violin hands, very small, tapering fingers, and it was even hard for him to stretch an octave. And I've always thought this was so elegant. Of course, Edward Weston was a divine photographer. So Ansel gets his Zeiss contacts, and at the same time, he invites O'Keefe to go on a trip to the Sierra. He's been telling her and Stieglitz, her husband Stieglitz, about the Sierra since they first met in 1933, and nobody ever wants to come visit. And finally, O'Keefe says, yes, I'll come. So he goes to, he arranges a pack trip into the Sierra, but first they do a trip to the Southwest. That's their first trip. And he goes and stays at the Ghost Ranch. So here's O'Keefe out painting in her wonderful, wonderful woody station wagon. And here's the whole group that then arrives to go to tour the Southwest. They're going to go to the canyon to Shea. That's the principal site that they're going to go to. Ansel wants to show off the glories of the Southwest. And so here's Ansel without a beard, and you can see how crooked his nose is. We once stood in front of the mirror because Time Incorporated called up and said, we want to run a self-portrait of you This was 1976 or 77. So would you go take a contemporary self-portrait? So he grabs me and he says, let's go downstairs to the back bedroom where there's an old kind of 19th century wooden mirror. And he sets up his Polaroid, and I'm standing looking right over his shoulder, and I don't recognize him because his nose went, whichever way his nose went, I was used to seeing it, but in the picture, in the mirror, it went the other way, and it was really like looking at a totally different person. So, and then here we have David McAlpin, who's a famous photography collector and collected O'Keeffe and was a big pal of Stieglitz's. And then this was Godfrey Rockefeller, Dave's cousin and the wife, and here's O'Keeffe, and she even then was wearing these really unattractive headscarves. So here they are, and Ansel was so excited about this. Ansel wrote, he wrote Stieglitz, I'm sorry you're not here, Alfred, or only called him Stieglitz. He says, I feel like a kid on Christmas morning. For him to be able to show off the Southwest to O'Keeffe, he was very taken with O'Keeffe. So they go to the Canyon de Chelly. And this is what it looks like from the top. It's very hard to photograph the Canyon de Chelly because, anyway, this is one of the best photographs I've ever seen of the Canyon de Chelly. And so they say so here they are at the rim, and so they all get out, and everybody's got their own photographs. Everybody that went with Ansel always wanted to take their version of the picture, and if they ever saw his tripod put up, they'd rush right over and set their tripod up right next to him because they were sure if Ansel was photographed, that must be the view. But then the trouble is, because this happened with his friend Cedric Wright, they were hiking in the High Sierra in 1932, and Ansel made a really wonderful photograph called Frozen Lake and Cliffs, which is kind of an abstract of a glacier melt and a lake and rock cliffs, very stern. Alfred Stieglitz would have loved this photograph. Cedric Wright rushes over with his tripod and sets his tripod and camera up right next to Ansel. And they both take their photographs. But Cedric doesn't see Ansel's photograph for about 10 or 15 years. And when he does, I found this because I curated Ansel's archive. Here's this letter from Cedric. Well, Ansel, he says, geez, J-E-E-Z, why didn't I see that? Well, his photograph was probably just kind of factual, and Ansel's photograph was telling you how he felt at the time standing there looking. So here's everybody arranged around the overlook. And here's some more pictures of O'Keeffe, some taken at her place. This was taken at the Ghost Ranch. She loved, this is where she would collect her bones to paint. And then here, this is right here where we're standing, I mean, where they were standing at the Canyon de Chelly. And then Ansel makes this really wonderful picture. And what he said, why he had never liked the 35-millimeter camera before, because it was for life and for people and for moments in time, and that's what this was. And he just seized the moment with it. If he'd had a view camera, and he wrote about this, he would never have had time to set it up. Then it would have been posed. This was just a moment in time. The funny thing is, O'Keeffe flirted with everybody. She'd come and stay with Ansel, and she flirted with everybody. I mean, none of the women in the room existed, but only the men did. But she would flirt with them, even though she was over 90 at that point. And she's flirting with the guide here. This is Orville Cox. He was a wrangler at the Ghost Ranch, and she got him to come along and run the trip for her. And at a certain point, I was working for Ansel, and Ansel got a letter from Orville Wright's daughter. And she said, my father and mother are dead, but I would really like to have a photograph that you took of Orville Wright and my mother. Would you send me a print? And I'm thinking, she doesn't have one? And then she says, my mother was so angry about the photograph that she tore it up. I mean, I don't know whether there was anything going on here or this was just for the, just for, she really did pose for the camera, but it's a great photograph. So it looks a little muddy right here. See how it looks a little muddy in the middle here? Well, that's because there's airbrushing, because when you had a 35-millimeter strip negative, you'd hang it up after you developed it, and you'd hang it up there with this little string across the workroom with a clothespin. And the one with this negative dropped off and fell on the floor, and luckily Ansel, not anybody else, stepped on it and made terrible, terrible scratches across the middle, which meant it was just impossible to spot. Usually you spot a photograph because there inevitably are dust spots that on the lens when you're photographing, and they're white spots, and you want those to disappear. And it was just really it was terribly hard to try and spot this. So I thought I'd show you here the negative strips, and here's, go away. Here we go. Here are the two. He clicked the shutter twice. Ansel always said there was no excuse for taking more than one picture. If you knew what you were doing, and you should know what you were doing, or you shouldn't be taking a photograph, you knew, for starters, you had everything in your fingertips. You didn't need to think about aperture, lens, anything else. It was all just like when you're playing the piano. You've got your technique in it, right? You know how to do it. And so in this instance, the first one he took, see how his hat hits her? Ansel would have hated that because he liked everything to be really clean. You could see in the good photograph here, there's a nice separation. So see how they're kind of cut off at the waist here? He describes how he had to kneel down. And you could really only do this with your 35-millimeter camera, to change your vantage point, to change the vantage with the arrangement of the hat. He composed his photographs so carefully. That's why it was hard for him to take photographs of people in a kind of a conversational setting. They don't hold still. And this, you know that Alfred Siegels was married to George O'Keefe, and this is one of Ansel's great portraits, I think. If that's a great portrait with a 35-millimeter camera, this is a great portrait with a six by eight. And Stieglitz is sitting in front of his favorite O'Keeffe painting, some sort of kind of curve that was recently on display even at the Whitney a few years ago. And I asked Ansel, I said, what is this interesting dark stuff here? He said, oh, that's grease from Stieglitz's hair. And this is really just kind of beaver board. He had a shelf that went all the way around his office. This is at the Horace Gallery on Madison Avenue. A shelf, and so he could prop up. There were, you know, sculpture and other paintings. And then there were bookshelves underneath, and he covered it up with this kind of ugly beaver board. It's a good thing this is just black and white. And then he photographed Ansel was in love with Stieglitz and O'Keeffe. So here was just made in heaven, right? O'Keeffe paintings in Stieglitz's gallery, an American place. And then on the second trip they made, when they went into the Sierra, this is a photograph that's, they're posed, what can I say? But, hold on. There's Dave McAlpin right there, and Ansel's taking the picture, and here's O'Keefe, and this must be whoever the wrangler is. I don't think it's Orville Cox, it's somebody else. And they're up in the Tuolumne Meadows region, and see this peak back here? When they're here, O'Keefe turns to Ansel and says, well, tell me, what's that nice little peak up there? And Ansel says, oh, well, actually, that will be Mount Ansel Adams someday. And then she turned to him, according to Ansel, and said, well, now I know why you brought us up here, just to show us your little mountain. And so here's Ansel's photograph. Not taken at the same time, taken a little later, and that's Mount Ansel Adams. It doesn't assume your name until after you die, so it has a canister. Someone from the Sierra Club early on has put a canister on top of it because they've been hiking around in that area, and it had a canister. So then, you know, 1 year after you die, it assumes your name. So it's Mount Ansel Adams, and that's where Ansel's ashes are scattered. His son and his family went up there. And a lot of people from the National Park Service went too, because they also at the same time were dedicating the Ansel Adams Wilderness, and they all had to come in by helicopter. Ansel's family went in on foot. And here's his last portrait of O'Keefe. This is a terrible reproduction, I'm embarrassed. But it shows you, you know, this is his idea of a portrait, where you're sitting very, very quietly. He's got her posed on a little step stool right outside the front door, and they had all these kind of ferns there. And she's almost totally... bald, so she's got a white, she always wore a little white handkerchief tied around her head, and she's wearing her wonderful Calder pin, silver OK, which she always had on at her neck. And at this point, she's almost blind. Now I want to show you something about a picture with his 8x10 camera called Clearing Winter Storm. We're going to talk about Winter Sunrise. We're going to the east side of the Sierra, so it's not a national park, but I want to show you. Here he is. This is the way he liked to photograph best, on the platform on his cars. He started having platforms applied in about 1937. And I'd never asked him, Ansel, how the heck did you get up there? Because it's farther than you think. And I don't know whether you stepped on this big thing here or how you got up there. And so this is post. You know, he's not photographing anything. This, his friend Nancy Newhall, they set this up to take a picture, and it, but it shows you what it was like when he was photographing on his car. And that's the way he was photographing this scene. And his feeling with the platform on the car is you were higher, you just had a better overview. You know, the same way with the stump. He wanted to get up so he could look down a little bit. So this is one of his most famous photographs, Winter Sunrise, taken in 1943. And I wanted to take you through a few things. Here's what a print in 1980 looks like. And you can see, but this is what a print with no manipulation looks like. This is actually pretty much what it looked like when he was there, although this is a low contrast print. So in fact, you could print it a little more forcefully and you'd have a little more information, but you can see how it's got the bones, but boy, it sure needs some interpretation. And you, at this point, you can still see the LP. This is for the high school at Lone Pine, which was the little town nearby, and the students every year when they graduated would go up there and whitewash the rocks LP. And this used to drive Ansel crazy. It was environmental, you know, degradation. He was very upset that they would do this to this beautiful view. And so his assistant would always have to spot this out on the finished print, and it would always show a little bit, because the spotting ink, over a while, it'll kind of change color a little bit. It was never very successful. And he used to say, oh, I wish I could just etch out that LP. And he said that so many times that his assistant, one of his assistants who was working for Ansel when I was there, finally, as he said, just etched it out. Now, you don't take a famous photographer's negative, especially one of his 10 most famous negatives, and alter it. When I told his other assistant this, he said, wow, Alan was really brave. It's just, and Alan didn't dare mention this to Ansel, but the next time Ansel went into the darkroom to print, he looked and said, oh, look, the LP is gone. And he was happy. So again, then this is what he did. So he was thinking about, he knew before he even got the car there, he knew he wanted to take this photograph for a long time. And even before he got out of the car, before dawn, so it's dark because you've got to have the streaming sunlight coming in here at dawn. Even before he got out of the car, he knew he wanted to have a succession of layers, gray, white, black, and then some brightness in the foreground. So he visualized, again, what he was going to do. Now here's, I wanted to show you, this is an earlier print, which looks a little brighter. There's a little more information in here, and the sky is lighter. And I'm always torn, do I like the latest print? The other one was from 1980. That's very late in life when he was printing darker. But hard to say. But here is a picture that he took about 6 years earlier of the same, just see the LP right here, very close by. And that time he even wrote, I know I want to take a picture here, but I haven't got it yet. I'm going to have to return, and I'm going to have to return at sunrise. This is not at sunrise. You can see because the sun is too high. He knew he had to be there at sunrise. And I wanted to show you, here's the same idea again, even earlier. This is a very early picture from 1932 of these bands. He does this all the time. So, and you notice that in Winter Sunrise, there's a horse. Well, in fact, he thought it was a stump. And just as he clicked the shutter, the stump turned and it was a horse. And so people always ask me, well, Ansel's criticized because he doesn't have animals or people in his photographs. And he just didn't felt they were necessary. He said, there are always people in my photographs. There's me and you looking at it. And I don't know, wildlife just didn't interest him at all. And here's a photograph by Ansel that does have wildlife, but it's a commercial photograph for the Curry Company to advertise, come visit Yosemite in the winter. So that's why he's got some deer here. And then he did put people in photographs when they were commercial purposes, again for the Curry Company, to encourage people to come. And what's interesting about this photograph, so here's El Capitan in the background. And he has lots of wonderful photographs of El Capitan, minus the people. But this one is interesting because this is Patsy English. This is the woman that Ansel wanted to leave his wife for. He had a wife and two children, and they were only like 2 and 4. And he fell in love with his darkroom assistant. She wasn't really knowledgeable about photography. But she was extraordinarily beautiful. Witness, she was a model. People, when they meet me, and after they hear me talk, you'd be surprised who asks if you had an affair with Ansel Adams. And I say, absolutely not. He was in his, if I started work, he was 72 when I met him. But this is me getting married to somebody else with Ansel in attendance. He's the best man, and I'm marrying his business manager, Bill Turnage. And this is in his house. This is the kind of the big gallery in his house with lots of photographs on one wall. And he's doing this. Next I want to talk to you about his humor. Every time someone pointed a camera at him, he'd do this strange kind of look. And he was, what you wanted to say was just be yourself, Ansel. But he'd pose. Before we go on to this photograph, I want to talk to you about Ansel's humor. One of my jobs when I worked for him was I had to tell him what to print at any given time. Every week I'd put up a new list in the darkroom because he'd print every single day, Monday through Friday, plus weekends when we weren't there. And so he'd always write on a little 3x5, white 3x5 card, and he'd type it because he couldn't write. And so he'd sometimes, here's some salutations. Dear Anchovist, Dear Delectable, Dear Mrs. Muir, Dear Shining Light, My Dear, D-E-E-R, Darling, Dear Gorgeous Siren of Gotham. He could never forget that I was from New York. He hated New York. Then he would sign his notes, J.D. Rockefeller, Beelzebub Esquire, Gladstone, Big Bunny, I had a pet rabbit, Joe Gravelboot, Friar Adamovici, Alcibiades, Your Potential Medalist and Weary Admirer, Not Weary of You, Just Weary. So I wanted to read also something that one morning I found this postcard on my chair. Dear Shining Light, Prithee, fair maiden, guide thy slave to the hallowed sequence of producing images. Is everything listed on the sacred scrolls? And it's signed, Saint Anselm the Curd. So before I left that night, I typed up a list for him, and I stamped with his red priority stamp. He loved stamps. He had stamps for everything. Priority all over it to get his attention. And it wasn't just a list on the wall. It was a huge sheet of paper on his chair, and he was up in the office by 7:30 in the morning. And I told him that he needed to make 39 good prints of Clearing Winter Storm. That's this print, and he had to do it that week. So in the next morning when I walk in the door, there's a letter from Ansel to me. He says, and I use words like, you have to make me 39 prints this week. We must not miss this deadline. It had to do with dealers paying, and then you'd send some more, and then they'd pay. And if you threw it off, the whole schedule got out of whack, and everybody got upset. So Ansel writes me, pursuant to your order of December 16th, 1977, I immediately took 2 transines and 1 shot of Jim Daniels. I thereupon collected myself, established a perspective on women's lib for a moment, and then decided there was nothing I could do but follow orders. Accordingly, I have celebrated the rainstorm by staying indoors and going through 18 sheets of paper of varying complexion and response, and I believe I shall avoid execution at dawn because I have a good sample of prints to come. That's all capitals. Tomorrow I shall do 80. That should be enough to end up with 39, just the 39 steps to arduously stumble up. But rest assured, I know terror when I see it. Your obedient servant, Alfred Stieglitz. P.S. I just want to check you wanted Clearing Dust Storm near Yuma? ? So, And this is the first photograph that I really fell in love with when I saw it when we opened up Ansel's show at the Metropolitan Museum. I just stood there for ages, and I'd never been to Yosemite. My idea of a national park was the Grand Canyon, where you got out of the car and looked down in the trench, right? And so I had no idea that something could be as moving as the Sierra. So here's Ansel inserting the negative. See, it's upside down. Is it backwards too? Gosh, I think maybe it is. And here he is. Then he's doing his manipulation in the darkroom, the dodging and burning, which is what makes a sky exist that didn't exist before, and makes the mountains dark when they started out light. And so as he does this called dodging and burning, and it's kind of like a ballet, and you're moving all the time, and there's a beeper going beep, 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 and then the water's running, and then there's this terrible, dreadful smell of this of the chemicals. And when he took me in there, my first week working for him, he said, oh, come in the dark with me, dear. And he went in to print this, and I thought, oh, but this will be very interesting, because I heretofore had thought that you just kind of sent the negative out and somebody printed it like at Kodak for me. So I was going to see the real thing. And it doesn't mean that you have to know that this happens. You don't need to know any of this happens to appreciate Ansel's photographs. You shouldn't. You should just appreciate them as they are. But if you know some of this other stuff, it's really cool. So we go in there, and the door is closed, and you cannot leave because you'll fog all the photographic papers. So I'm sitting there, and this beeper's going. And you do, it's like 5 minutes of this dodging and burning stuff all over different. And he's counting because the clicker's going, and he's got this thing. Oh, hold on. This is what he's doing. This is his choreography. So those are all seconds. But then there's some passes first that aren't even shown on here. So a really terrible photograph to print, like Mount McKinley and Wonder Lake, could be 6 or 7 minutes. So imagine doing this, and I told him I want 39. And the repetitive, he's already 77 years old when I'm asking him to do this. It's a concrete floor with a rubber mat, but even so, let me tell you, he was really something. So here, if we go back, so here he is doing this. And this is what you start out with if you just do a straight print. Really an interesting sky, right? And this is what he does with the dodging and burning. He makes it look just fantastic. I mean, who knew all this was there? And you can't make it up. Now, the trick is, if you had Photoshop today, could you do it? Well, I guess so. And Ansel would have been the first person to say that Photoshop was terrific. But I don't know. I'm not sure. And here he is with a photograph, a big print of this at the Museum of Modern Art in 1979 when they had a big show of his work. Now, I have to finish with Moonrise. I know I've talked a long time. With Moonrise, because that's Ansel's most famous picture. And here's what you got if he hadn't stopped photographing this stump, he wouldn't have taken Moonrise. He said he spent a long time with this stump trying to get it to behave, and it wouldn't. And this was unusual for Ansel because he usually either got it right away or he didn't. He said you should never wait around for something. Either the clouds are right or they aren't. He just didn't understand people that wanted to wait for something. You take it. So here's Moonrise, which you all know. It's very big on this. And I can see that I've got to ask my friend, my techno whiz, to put a white border around it because you can't even see where the sky ends up there. So it's this, he was driving back from, he'd been at O'Keefe's house in up in the Chama Valley, and he's driving down towards Santa Fe, and through this little town, it goes by this town called Hernandez, and he sees off to his left this moon over the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, and he says, oh gosh, inevitable photograph. So his son was with him at this point, it's 1941, his son must be about 9 or 10, and so he always said he almost ditched the car because he had to stop so fast because the sun was about to set, and if the sun set, you wouldn't have any light on the moon. So time was of the essence. But this is actually what he saw. That's not very interesting, is it? And he said even when he, with this only 3 minutes maximum to get up on the top of the car, have somebody hand him his tripod, have his son hand him his camera, put the dark slide in or whatever it is with the glass, the film holder, and calculate the exposure of the, he couldn't find his light meter. So he knew that the moon is, only Ansa would know this sort of arcane stuff, the moon is 250 candles per square foot, so if you put that on zone this, and you do that, and you do that, and that, then you need to do this, and the exposure's this and this. Oh, well, anyway, that's what he said, your technique has to be, you know, at your fingertips. You can't stop and look in your book about what to do. So he took the photograph, and he said even as he took the photograph, he knew he wanted the sky to be black. Here's what the negative looks like. You can see it's very dull in the foreground. He said if he had it to do over when he would have changed the exposure slightly. As it was when he got home, he gave it a water... Who is interested in this besides me? A water bath development, which is going to give a little bigger range of tones here, so it's not kind of a gray mush. But see this? The cloud is just solid white here, this means. And that's such a no-no. And there's just barely enough light on the moon here. And see all these clouds up here? Well, here's the first print he made. This was made just a couple of months after he took the negative. And he's darkened the sky, right? But he's still got some clouds showing. And this is, he would not like this later on. This is a no-no. You had to kind of somehow get some detail in here. And it looks kind of okay, but it's not that arresting. So this, again, is the late print from 1980 when he's taken the sky all the way down. Now it's black. Now when people see this photograph, they think it's moonlight by moonlight. They have no idea the sun was setting. And it's really so. But I have to tell you, I think it's really spectacular. I personally would like a little cloud up here. Maybe a little less black. But anyway, and you notice it's what he called a gibbous moon. It's before... Because I thought about this, if you wanted to make this photograph really trite, and some people think it's trite anyway, you would have put the moon smack dab in the middle, not off center, and you would have had a full moon, not a gibbous moon. So, but Ansel, even then, as fast as it had to be, knew that it had to be something else. So now I have to finish really fast. I know I'm out of time. Ansel was a great environmentalist. And we haven't really touched on that. He felt that your day was not complete unless you'd written at least one letter or made a call to a senator, the president, somebody in Congress, somebody. He really cared about the environment right down to his fingertips. And so President Carter asked Ansel to take his formal photograph, both a photograph with Rosalind, and then also the president's portrait, you know, just a headshot, and the vice president. So, and this was a big deal because everybody else had kind of terrible paintings. So we go to the White House. I'm along, naturally. This is, boy, talk about really exciting. And we go upstairs to the private quarters, and Jimmy Carter's standing here, and Rosalind, and Ansel, and Bill Turnage, and me. And Ansel turns to Mrs. Carter and says, "And what would you like to wear?" And she says, "Oh, I don't know." And Ansel says, "Well, Andrea will go with you and choose a dress." And so I thought, I'm just going to pretend I'm not here. So I stood right there, and I thought, if I don't say anything, I'm not here. And Ansel says, "Andrea, go with Mrs. Carter." And, you know, she's got this whole room, enormous room, that's a closet with all the racks, with all the clothes hanging up for trips. I mean, they're all lined up with the dresses, shoes, pocketbooks, everything. And I'm thinking, oh, this couldn't possibly be happening. This will make or break the photograph, right? And we walk in the room, and I think, this is just absolutely a disaster. Red is my favorite color. And I see the red, and it's from the side. I mean, it's just, and I say, "What about that red dress?" And it makes the picture, because Ansel took them in the door to the, is this called the East Room? Dwayne, you've been there. Is this the East Room? Or the West Room or something? And say Ansel knew he wanted to photograph them here with George Washington in the background, and the red dress makes it. With a blue dress or a green dress, this photograph is just absolutely not going to work, which just shows you should always trust your intuition. However, the Carters were not not there for the setup. I stood in with the truck driver. I was Mrs. Carter, and with the truck driver who was driving the truck with all the equipment. And I thought you'd like to see this. One of Ansel's assistants sent me this about 10 years ago, and I'd completely forgotten it. And I thought, oh my gosh, isn't that amazing? Wish I had that kilt. And while he was there photographing Carter, because it took several days for the setups, and then he did Carter's formal portrait in the dining room, where they have that fabulous, fabulous 18th century wallpaper of, what's on the wallpaper, Duane? It's just like revolutionary time, right? It's French Zubair wallpaper. And so he's got Carter in front of that, so that takes a lot of setup, lights and all this sort of stuff. And the whole time he's working with Carter, he's telling him he's got to make sure they pass the Alaska Lands Bill, because that will protect millions of acres in Alaska. And, of course, Carter thinks that's right, but, you know, everybody else is around him. There's a lot of people that don't want this bill to pass. And Ansel just kept harping away on this in the nicest possible way. I mean, how do you bring up Alaska when you're standing in the doorway? But he did. And Ansel sent them afterwards this photograph of Mount McKinley and Wonder Lake, which isn't a part of the area that was in question, because this is already a national park. But apparently they were very pleased. And this is the negative that's probably the most difficult negative for Ansel to print. So, and I'm terribly sorry that this reproduction isn't very good. But you can notice there's a little bit that's out of focus here. Those are a herd of mosquitoes. Lifting off, Ansel said, and this is taken at 1 a.m. Of course, it's the land of the midnight sun. Now, the actual negative, once again, has, you know, the sky is light, even though it's 1 a.m. It's the land of the midnight sun. In the summer, and I like the earlier prints of this that have a little more definition here. This reproduction is also terrible. I can't remember whether it's a book or what, but and sometimes this always reminds me of a chocolate sundae. It's one of my favorite pictures. I have a little old print of this up at home, and I just like to look at it. So that's the end. But I thought I'd show you Ansel in his darkroom apron. This is the way when I arrived in the morning. The house would be quiet, and as if nobody was there, and I'd hear the water dripping and the thing going beep, beep, beep in the darkroom, the door would be closed. And at a certain point, I'd arrive at 9, Ansel would have been in the darkroom since 7:30 or 8, and the door would slide open, and Ansel would walk out holding a dripping wet print, the wet, so it looked kind of like fabric. And he's holding it up, and he says, "I think I got it." And that's the way I remember Ansel best, was that he's so happy, he's so excited that he's got it. And he would have been wearing this really dreadful brown rubberized apron. Oh. And he'd put his purchase glasses up on his head like this. And you can see here that he's the arthritis in his fingers. But he never complained. He never complained about this arthritis. It couldn't have felt very good in the cold water in the dark room. And this is his office in here. He never would have put all these. He had PhDs from everybody, including Harvard. And if you wanted to see somebody embarrassed, it was Ansel sitting on the dais at Harvard with Leontine Price and a lot of other people, and because he didn't even graduate from high school, and he always had such a chip on his shoulder because he didn't graduate from high school, and all these other people had all these degrees. He was every bit as brilliant as they were. He just had learning disabilities and had to quit school after eighth grade, and be tutored by his father. And the last picture is, this is what I looked like. Of course, I haven't aged. This is right after I started working for Ansel. And see, even here, this wonderful sense of humor. I wanted to put this picture on the dust jacket of my book because it shows Ansel being funny. The trustees of the Ansel Adams Trust said this made Ansel look foolish. And I thought, oh, no, he just looks like fun. So I had to just put on a black and white photograph. Anyway, that's one of my favorite pictures. And it's a Polaroid SX-70, for those of you who remember what SX-70s were. Okay, that's it. Thank you. Anybody can ask questions if they'd like. I hope I got across how much fun Ansel is. He was really fun to be with. He always had a darkroom assistant. He'd never had an assistant like me who just worked typing letters and doing the invoices, and the darkroom assistant had to do everything. But, of course, when I came to work for him in 1974, the photography market just went, if it had been like this, it went... And so I was there. That's one reason they hired me, because he needed help. No longer could the darkroom assistant also help with the correspondence, editing anything Ansel wrote, and he was asked to write things all the time. And, you know, even writing the titles on the back of the photographs, checking the photographs before Ansel signed them, dealing with people, you know, anybody could call up Ansel's house and say, A, I want to come visit you, and you could come at 5 p.m., and B, I'd like to buy a photograph. So I was the point person for that, and I'll never forget, the first day I was there, I didn't have a desk yet, so I had a phone just kind of in the workroom, and I hear Ansel on the phone. He picks up the phone. Hello. Oh, yes. Well, I'd love to. Well, yes. Oh, what a nice idea. Well, I've never been to Cleveland before. Well, that just sounds wonderful. Now, what's your telephone number? And I'll get back to you about this. And I thought, isn't that nice? Somebody he's never met, as famous as he is, he's just going to fly out to Cleveland and do something there? He walks into the other room. I have only just arrived. Dear, he says. He never said Andrew. He says, dear, would you mind calling this lady back and tell her there's just no way I could possibly come to Cleveland? And I saw right away, this is my job description. Okay. I'm the heavy. So, I didn't really answer your question. Well, was the... He always had a darkroom assistant. He always had just one darkroom assistant. He made every single print himself. He just didn't understand how any photographer would let anybody else print his negatives. And in fact, after he died, John Sexton, who was, there were two darkroom assistants while I worked for him. You know, you kind of burn out as Ansel's darkroom assistant. It's very intense in the darkroom there. And they're all photographers in their own right, so they really want to get them on their own careers. And in a way, working for Ansel, you kind of get stuck because you kind of get labeled, and it's I'm not necessarily sure it's the best thing for a photographer. And wait a minute. So John Sexton said, why am I telling you about John Sexton? Oh, well, I can't remember. Let's hope those hormones kick in soon.
about one assistant.
Oh, no, I can't remember. Well, yes. Yes.
Did he talk about why he did that?
No. No. It's one reason I actually had to stop working for him, because I couldn't lie to him anymore when he came out of the dark room with a dripping wet print and said, isn't it beautiful? And what I wanted to say was, oh, no, my God, that's just terrible. But the same thing happened to Paul Strand. Paul Strand had his cataracts removed. And after he had his cataracts removed, he said to his two assistants, why didn't you tell me my prints are so dark? Oh. Ansel didn't have a very good eye doctor. It was Carmel. It was a teeny town at that point. And so finally, after I quit, because they were just getting so dark, you wanted to just say, please, no, no. And I tried. A couple of times I would trot out a carefully saved older print that was a little lighter. And I remember, and I said, Ansel, look, I happen to have, here's a Clearing Winter Storm that you made just a couple of years ago. Oh, dear. Oh, that is weak and anemic. This print is so much better. And the darkroom assistants were aware of this, too. So after a while, they began... part of the problem was that he not only would print too dark, so that it was just too contrasty, he would also tone too much. You put toner on a picture so that to take away a slight greenish tonality. And he would begin toning so much that they looked like 19th century photographs, sepia photographs. But he couldn't see that, and finally he was taken to a famous expert in Washington who told him, oh, you have cataracts, nothing to it, I can remove those. But he was, you know, it was 2 years before he died, and he didn't want to tinker with his eyes. So I don't blame him. And so his late prints are too dark, and most everybody agrees, curators, collectors, everybody, his late prints are just darker. And in some ways, John Sarkowski, the famous curator at the Modern, said, oh, Andrea, you're totally wrong. There's nothing wrong with Ansel's eyes. I don't care what that doctor said. It's just that he's feeling things more intensely. And it's the part of the world where it's so intense. So life is so busy. Oh, the environment, the politics. And I'm thinking, okay, well, I don't know. I heard what the doctor said, and you didn't. But so he just chose to believe that it was just Ansel's own choice. I don't think that was true. I really think Ansel actually, because you keep printing and toning more and more and more and more and more because you're trying to see black and white. And in fact, some of his early prints are a little anemic because he didn't have strong enough blacks, and that gives you then stronger whites. So they tend to be a little kind of gray. And what he was known for, but you could see from that early picture of, you know, with the lake, with the reflections, that was just pristinely beautiful in terms of the quality of the print. There was just nothing that you would change about that one iota. It was absolutely perfect. Unfortunately, most of his, if there are over 1,000 prints of Moonrise, most of them were made towards the end of his life. So when you see a really good earlier Moonrise, you're just thrilled. And what makes me sad is that the prints that he was making at the end of his life were what he called museum sets. I'm really letting my hair down here. Museum sets, and if you could buy a set of 25, 50, or 75 photographs for, I don't know, $100,000 or $25,000 or something, it was a long time ago, so the numbers don't sound so big now, and you could choose which 25 or 50 or 75 photographs you bought if you were going to give it away. And I drew up a list of museums that would be appropriate beneficiaries. And you could choose a museum from our list. And so those are the photographs that are mostly shown because every museum has them. But even the curators at the principal museums realize that this is, you know, product of late in his life. So now that's more than you wanted to know. So, okay. Dinner time.